session number 27073, Reel 9.
Food rate, Reel 9. You say where you were on Malta, it was gearing up for the attacks on Sicily.
For the invasion.
The invasion of Sicily.
Fairly uneventful. There wasn't a great amount of air opposition. And the invasion itself was successful. But we did a lot of patrolling and very little German opposition. So there wasn't much fighting. I can only remember really about three events that happened out there. One was that most of the Spitfire squadrons were re-equipped with the Spitfire 9, but not in their entirety. So you had a mixture of 5s and 9s. And as a leader, I always led in a 9. And once again, I hadn't been fully briefed on the airplane. And my second or third sortie over Sicily, I had been advised that there were some German airplanes in the vicinity. And just at that moment, there was an almighty bang. And I thought, God almighty, I've been attacked again. And not at all. What had happened was that the 9 had a dual supercharger. And at 18,000 feet, the supercharger, the second supercharger, came in at 18,000 feet. And nobody had warned me. So from then onwards, I always had my hand on the on the supercharger manual and was able to frighten myself whenever I felt like being frightened. So that was one instance, and then things became very slow in Sicily and Messina and everywhere else in Italy. And one of my squadron commanders and I decided that we'd go and have a look at a port, I've forgotten the name of it, in Sicily, that was still in Axis hands, and see whether there's anything there worth doing something about, because we had heard there were some flying boats there, and or seaplanes. So we landed at an ex-German airfield, refueled, and next morning at dawn, set off for this harbour in Italy. But it was a dead calm. We had to keep under radar coverage. It was a dead calm, and I couldn't see where the sea was at all. And I thought, well, this is highly dangerous, because we were down to about 5 feet. So both my squadron commander and I thought of the same thing. And so what I said was, Timber, would you please get slightly ahead of me so that the force of your propeller will disturb the sea, and I've got something that I can actually judge my height on. And so I flew the whole time looking at that, and he was flying on me still. And that's how we got to... Anyway, we got to this port, and there was nothing there, so we came home. But that was the memorable thing. How the hell do you compete?
Is there anything else you remember about that time when you were in Malta at all?
No, I was... yes. And by the time they had gone into Italy, I found that my wing had become the air defence wing of Malta, which wasn't my cup of tea at all. So I asked Keith whether I could go home because I was very tired. I'd had the desert and one or two other things in Cairo, and it was high time I went home.
How did you get home?
Oh, yes, somebody was going back to England in a mosquito, and I said, have you got a spare seat? He said, yeah. So I got back in a mosquito. Oh, sorry. Forget all that. Forget all that. Yeah. Of course not.
Was it aboard HMS Rodney?
That's right, yes, I don't remember. Yes. So Keith turned around and said, well, I've got another job for you. The Rodney and the Renown, I think it was, are going back to England, and I can get you a trip if you'd like it. I said, yeah, why not? So I went back to England in the Rodney, and then my first flight there was to be invited by the captain to be the aircraft spotter. And so he said, and your position will be in the crow's nest up there. I said, oh, thank you very much. So he said, and when we leave Valletta Harbour, we're going to have a shoot at a drogue just to see whether all our guns are. And there I was up at the crow's nest, looking down on this bloody ship, and they let go with all their light ack, and all the tracer stuff was coming straight at me, as far as I was concerned, straight at me, onto these drogues. And I've never been so bloody frightened in all my life, but I should have known that all these guns had a cut-off point that stopped the ammunition blowing up their tame Air Force officer.
What was your posting when you arrived back in the United Kingdom?
Straight away, I was posted to the 2nd Tactical Air Force. Stop it. Yeah, when I came back, I was given a very hefty long leave, which I looked forward to and enjoyed, and was then rung up and told that I'd been given a Typhoon wing at an airfield called Fairlop, which is near Hornchurch. And once again, who was my compatriot was Kilmartin. And so he was on the administrative side of this airfield, and I was the wing leader. And there were three Typhoon squadrons, and I'd never flown a Typhoon, so once again, there's the petrol, there's the hydraulic system, da 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 da. And so I learned on the job once again.
What was the Typhoon like, though? Because that's a much more powerful aircraft, isn't it? Again?
Well, it was a hefty old aeroplane, and very fast indeed, with a brand new engine, which I knew nothing, called Griff. No, I've forgotten. Anyway, it was a huge Sabre aeroplane, and it went very fast. But the thing that I had to learn was was armed either for rockets or for the release of bombs. So I had to find out how this was done. So I was sent up for a 2 weeks course to a place called Millfield, where they had the fighter leader school. And they, with my own aeroplane, I was taught how to fire rockets and how to aim bombs with the gun sights that we had in these aeroplanes at the time.
Well, obviously you'd done some bombing before, hadn't you, with the, in the desert?
That's right, yeah. And more or less the same system. We used variations of the bomb sight. It hadn't been specifically designed to release bombs, but we were told how to use it. And if you were diving at the correct angle of 60 degrees, you could aim a bomb extremely accurately.
Rockets is a different thing. Is there an effect on the aircraft when you release the rockets at all?
No. Not even if you released them all at one time. Because you had three methods of releasing rockets. Either separately, or ripple, boom, 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 or salvos. Even with a salvo, you just felt a small jolt, that was all.
And again, using the gun sight?
Using gun sight, but that was quite accurate for rockets. And so you could knock a tank out with a solitary rocket. But if in doubt, you just let them all go together.
I believe the Typhoon had some problems prior to you arriving. Had they all been ironed out at that stage?
No. We still had problems with the engine there because it's an air cooled engine, but the spindle of the main pumps, petrol pump, hydraulic pump, and the oil pump, was not man enough for the job, and they used to snap, with the result that your engine stopped. And it was a very heavy aeroplane. I, in fact, had one very close shave when leading the wing from Fairlop to one of these V2 targets in France. I was at took off at 0 feet from Fairlop, skirting London, but at this particular moment over Bromley at 0 feet with 24 Typhoons in the wing, when suddenly my engine stopped. But I was going quite fast and was able to pull the stick up to about 8,000, 9,000 feet. And I looked down there was Big Nell. And so I called up Big Nell, said, engine failure, permission to land. Da-da. They said, yeah, it's fine. There's a Spitfire wing taking off, but I think you can see that. Try and avoid them. And at that time, I had introduced for myself a new drill to ensure that I didn't leave out any of the procedures for releasing the bomb, etc., etc., etc. So there I was with no engine, and I had introduced this new drill, but I wasn't quite certain whether I had armed the bombs or not. And there I was, still with bombs, without anywhere to release them, because I would have released them over Bromley or somewhere else. So I called up and explained what was happening, that I was landing with the wheels up, and that I wasn't quite certain whether the bombs were alive or not, that there could possibly be a rather large bang. Anyway, as I got closer to my point of impact, I was saying to myself, well, now, in my new drill, have I done the right thing? And then I touched, or the bombs touched, because I had the wheels out, touch the runway, but there's no large bang, so I must have done the right thing. Anyway, I force landed these things, got out, and I was in my very best uniform, because from this particular mission I was going to meet Eisenhower, who was briefing all wing leaders and all squadron commanders what D-Day was all about. So there I was, prancing around in my number two or number one uniform, when the ambulance came up. Doctor got out and said, "Oh, where's the pilot?" And I had to inform him that I was the pilot. Anyway,
with that period when you were leading the wing, you mentioned there earlier that you were targeting V1 sites. Was that the main type of targets you were taking prior to D-Day, or were you attacking?
They were practically the only targets. Every day we had a new target to go for, and we were just knocking out the launch sites.
How did you lead the wing into that attack? Would you lead the wing? Would it be a whole wing that you would always lead together?
It'd be always two squadrons.
And what's the kind of method of attack?
Because they were very simple targets to verify, and quite small, and I'd get them into a position that I could roll over with everybody in line abreast, and they'd just follow me on the way down, dropping either the bombs or the rockets. They were very successfully, and it was quite a formidable weapon, that 24 Typhoons with I've forgotten how many rockets they had, but
it's eight
rockets each with 60-pound warheads. So it's quite a bang when they all with your slide rule you can work out how many rockets that was. There was a squadron of destroyers coming in.
And did you at that time come up against any, with the German defences, or did you come up against any German air opposition?
No, I didn't come across anything, because these were the only targets we were going at, and we had complete air superiority at that time.
That must have been quite a comforting feeling in many respects.
Yes, well, you didn't. Yeah, no, but you still had the light ACAC problem, and it was pretty fierce in France at that time.
I believe you also attacked Cherbourg with one in conjunction with 146.
Yeah, that was only one off. A friend of mine had been given the job of being the group captain in charge of three of our Typhoon wings. And he rang me up and said, "I got a job tomorrow, come to the briefing." So I landed at Tangmere, and he said, we're going to tackle Cherbourg. I said, "What do you mean, we? Have you ever been there?" He said, "Only once, pretty hairy, and just two of us." I said, "Look, you are taking over 30 Typhoons in there, and you're asking me to be Arsene Charlie of this. I'm going to get all the flak." He said, no, believe you. You'll be all right. I said, "Maybe, anyway, bollocks. I will, as you are telling me, I shall take part in this, but I'm not happy." And sure enough, we got over there, and I got everything, and I lost six pilots. And I came back storming mad, I really was, and told him exactly what I thought of him in front of all the other pilots. Didn't go down to, because he was then dressed up as a group captain. I was only a wing commander. And So next morning he comes down to Thorny Island where I was and walks into my office and said, don't you normally stand up when a senior officer walks in? I said, yes, I normally do, but not you, you bastard. So that didn't cement relationships.
Because I imagine then if he was, you would have been in the worst position coming in last of all, because would the flak over Cherbourg be particularly fierce?
Oh, God, it really was fierce. As I said, you've seen the Navy looking out the kamikaze, eyes of the kamikaze. Then, as I said, I lost six pilots, which...
It's a high percentage of the wing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Were they all casualties, or were some of them POWs?
About three of them were killed. Yeah. So anyway, as a result of all that, I was pretty tired, and they decided to send me on a rest period, and I was posted to command the. Fighter leader school on the ground attack side, which was rocketing and bombing. And so my job was to brief and to train, where necessary, all wing leaders, all squadron commanders on the use and the tactics to be used for rockets and for bombs on either Spitfires or Typhoons, and some naval pilots, I've forgotten what airplanes they had, also ditto, and a number of Americans. So that was my last flying appointment in the Air Force before being sent off to America to do the American Staff School staff course at Leavenworth.
With the role that you had at Millfield, obviously you were somewhat of a specialist for the amount of time that you
oh,
you'd
very,
done with
very attack, much so, yeah. Well, that was why it was called the Fighter Leader School.
Were there other people there, obviously, with different specialisms that they were...
No, they're practically all mates of mine. They're all you know, had more or less the same type of experience and had made it up to that time. So they're all very experienced people. But they'd never been taught anything about rockets or anything about dropping bombs off fighter aeroplanes.
And when you went to the US, I believe you came in contact with a couple of quite famous American pilots at that time.
Yes. The first one who sat beside me was a chap called Peterson, who had commanded the Eagle squadrons. And the other one, I've forgotten his name, I think it was called Bong.
Is it Richard Bong?
Richard Bong, who was the American Aces of Aces. And they were to my classmates.
What were they like as those two? Because they're obviously quite well...
Oh, the Americans. I'd already had contact with Americans. Because one thing I did forget was... at Alamein, the Americans came in with Kitty Hawks, and they were all brilliant and very experienced pilots, but without any operation experience. And Tedder wanted me to be promoted to the wing leader of the American Kitty Hawks, but the Americans turned around and said, under our constitution, an American unit cannot be commanded by a foreign thing. But what you can do is you can post Drake's squadron with Kitty Hawks into an American group, and for an accepted period he can lead those three squadrons as a wing leader. So that was my first experience of leading units of that dimension and of that nationality.
Do they do things differently?
No. The Americans are... I have all the respect, because I've done a lot of flying with them, got to know them very well. They admired us, they respected us, we liked them, and we respected them, and therefore there was a very healthy feeling of respect between the RAF and the American Army Air Corps, as it was then called. And so we had no problems there at all. They accepted our leadership and our experience.
Just back to that one where you're at the staff school with Richard Bong, do you have any major impressions of him as a...
No, just plain nice people. I found all Americans very easy to get on with, no problem at all. And there were a thousand students on this bloody course. And what is more, it still being the Army Air Corps, this was an Army staff school. And so we were indoctrinated according to Army doctrines and manuals and things. So we had to understand what that was all about.
Must have been a bit strange after so long.
A bit strange. But anyway, it was... it was an exercise.
Who did you go out there with from the UK?
I went out there with Peake Brothers and a bomber pilot by the name of Walmsley. And that was it. That's right, the three of us.
Had you had any contact with Peake Brothers before that point?
Oh, yes. On and off, I'd known him. I've known him all my service life. Yeah.
Again, that goes back to... that period when you would, when the Air Force was rather like a small
that's
family,
right.
doesn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah.
Is
yeah.
that where you met? Because you mentioned lots of people who you have known.
One knew a lot of faces, put it this way, and their Christian names. You had no clue who the hell they were, but...
I think it's trapped up there, Billy. Yeah. You were saying you knew lots of faces.
Lots of faces, we had good weekends.
It's interesting, because obviously some points about that with the RAF system of rotation seems a very good way of getting good working relationships.
Oh, yes, I mean, your social life and your operational life and your flying life were all intermingled. And so those who kept on not being killed, we got to know each other more intimately as we were all promoted more or less at the same time into the various jobs we had.
I believe actually your next posting was also to an American.
Yes, next straight from the Staff College, I was posted to SHAPE headquarters, to Eisenhower. And my job was to keep the top brass in SHAPE headquarters up to date on the air condition, the air situations. And so I used to talk to either Tedder or Eisenhower or Spatz every morning on the air situation. And then the war came to its conclusion, and the armistice was in fact signed by all three years. The country's services at SHAPE headquarters at Reims, and I was actually on the signing as an observer.